Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are back talking COVID, healthcare, public healthcare and resourcing it. As always, I'm joined by my co-host. And just so you know, folks, we got him up specially. He literally has been turned over in the bed and he just got down and now he's back up. Martin, what's it like to be up on a rainy Saturday morning?
At 10 o'clock and you've been out jogging. And I said to you, why, what use is it to you? You'll get pneumonia. How healthy is that? It's just madness. You Leo people.
I was told by a very good medic that running out in the cold is very good for the immune system. It boosts the immune system. So I'm going to take that line and stick to it. stop it now. bit of housekeeping. Better say, by the way, this morning today is my eldest. She's 15, and I just want to say happy birthday because I should say happy birthday. And I suppose in this, given what we're going to talk about, it does talk about, you know, the how things are different for everybody now and how a birthday party is over Zoom and we're doing it all in this way. So happy birthday to my eldest, and she'll kill me if she ever hears this. That's
Tony was a child bride, by the way. He was a child bride. He's very young still.
Listen. It's the topless running that keeps me looking young.
Oh, God.
much more importantly, we're actually thrilled to be joined on the line by Dr. Marie Casey, who is a specialist in public health medicine and works as a consultant in public health. Marie, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much, Tony and Martin. It's nice to join you this morning, early-ish.
we have been batting things back and forth, trying to come up with a time because you've been so busy. You have been absolutely extraordinarily busy. And before we sort of started recording, we did speak briefly, and you mentioned how, you know, being on an emergency footing now for 10 months. How do we stand? Are we still fighting the fire that's around our feet?
It does feel a little bit like that at the moment, I think. You know, everything happened very quickly last year in March, and we had to put a lot of things in place very quickly, including in public health as well. And I suppose we've struggled a little bit to get our feet under us. Now, I think there are positive things happening. You know, vaccination is happening, and that's a great thing for us all. But I just think people are tired. And I think when people are tired, they kind of want to plan and they want to have a kind of clear direction. They want to know what's going to happen in the next while. And I think very much so in the last 10 months, we've spent every week living week to week or day to day, sometimes looking at the numbers. And that's a hard way to live. So that's what I think. I think we're at a time where we need to reflect a little bit on what we need to put in place, what preparations we need to make.
I suppose the analogy that keeps being used, we've spoken to loads of the guys in the independent scientific advocacy group, and one of them is saying, you know, like going back to the fire, that the fire that is in the room that you're standing in, you're putting it out, but you don't even realize that the entire house is up in flames as well. So you can't see the wood from the trees in some ways. And you've just, what you're referencing, I think I'm right in saying that if we could step back, we'd realize we need a plan, a strategy to actually counter the entire thing, as opposed to just continually dealing with what's happening the 6 inches from our face.
I think so, because, you know, we had a curveball before Christmas with the UK variant. That was something. Now, that wouldn't be unexpected, that, you know, you do get mutations in viruses. That's the way they work. So that was a bit of a curveball, and it just kind of, I think for me, it reminded me that, you know, there could be other surprises, other things could happen. And I suppose the kind of surprises I'm talking about would be other variants emerging, which they will, even though this particular virus doesn't mutate as extensively as other viruses, but it still does. I think the other kind of surprises we might have are, you know, possibly around vaccine. We're not quite sure how long the immunity lasts, and I suppose if more variants come, the kind of protection that they give, I'm hoping it'll go fine, and I'm sure probably will. But it's just that I think we need a bit of an insurance for that, for different possibilities, you know. I think as well as that, we have to look at, we've put a lot of infrastructure in place on the hoof, like definitely in public health and alongside public health as well, the contact tracing centres. And I'd really like to see us kind of get to a point where we're evaluating where we are, what we have, what additional stuff we need to put in place and what things we might need to stand up in case something comes out of that we're not prepared for. You know, it's just getting into that kind of proactive space, really.
It's when you say contact tracing, is that something that we should have focused on when we had quiet months last summer? Or is it something that's just sort of was kind of taken for granted that it would work?
Yeah, so I suppose last summer was interesting. So contact tracing, maybe I'll explain a bit about how everything is organized at the moment, because it's not everyone understands it. Sometimes I wonder if I understand it. But there's contact tracing centers, and that's where every case of COVID goes through. And a call handler will phone you and tell you, you know, you've got COVID, and they'll ask you for close contacts and they'll ask you for basic information about yourself. But if you have a complex element about you, so just say, for example, you work in a nursing home or you work in a supermarket and you were there while you're infectious or something like that, that will be flagged and sent to a regional department of public health, like where I work. So there's kind of two parallel systems working alongside each other doing contact tracing. And I suppose last summer, the capacity was reduced in the contact tracing centre because it got quieter. And the regional public health departments like I work in, we had a lot of redeployed staff from other parts of the HSC, you know, who'd never worked in public health before, but were literally, I arrived into work one morning and there was 20 people in there looking at me and I'd never met any of them before. And they were told that they're going to be working in public health and they had to start in about 30 minutes. And could we give them a bit of training about how they were going to answer the queries from the public? But so we had those kinds of people, but those people immediately went back to their routine jobs in the HSC, like all essential jobs as well, but they were already deployed back during the summer when the numbers fell. And I suppose I feel we missed an opportunity there. That, you know, when you have a little bit of quiet time, it's time to start preparing, improving your processes, you know, getting a bit of training in place. So we in our departments missed an opportunity. Unfortunately, as well, there was a bit of, and this was something I worried about from the start, was using redeployed staff to staff our public health departments, because it's about whether they would want to come back or not, because they actually have other jobs. And we were told they will come back. Of course they will. The minute you need them, they'll be there. But that just didn't happen for us. Not in my department anyway. I think we had about 50 people redeployed to us in March. And I think about three came back. So that left us in a pretty, really tight spot. We got approval then after that to get temporary people employed into our departments. That took a little bit of time. But then again, we were on the cycle of training again in the middle of another wave two. So it's been difficult, I think. And we haven't really hit a steady state yet in public health. And that's what I would like to see us get to and put our energies into at the moment.
You know? You point out there, and I know I've seen even you have had difficulty filling positions recently. So, I mean, the resourcing issue remains very, very fragile, very stretched from what I can see. And if you don't mind me quoting you, I think you said sometimes you feel like you're trying to dig a mountain with a spoon.
At the moment, we have absolutely brilliant people working with this. We've got a lot of agency staff and people like that. But again, it's really hard to train, organize yourself, plan in teams when people are very like working week to week on contract. You know, the recruitment that we had recently was for an admin person in our department, and actually for four posts, but it was an internal recruitment in the HSC, so we didn't manage to recruit anyone to our department, unfortunately. So it's difficult. We just kind of seem to continually end up in a little bit of a cycle like this. I'm not sure every department is like this, because some people find it easier to recruit than others, but it's just where we are at the moment anyway, unfortunately.
Does the recruiting difficulties and the staffing difficulties, does that add to the kind of battle fatigue that healthcare workers are feeling at the moment?
I think it really does for us. I definitely think we felt it this week when me and colleagues were talking to each other about it. It's just, I think what's really challenging about public health is we were very much underdeveloped for years and years and years. So there was no real workforce planning going on, although that was starting again recently. And this pandemic really caught us at a terrible time because we were just about to start addressing it. So there was no standardization of jobs. There was no job descriptions done up. We have no dedicated HR to deal with public health. So that's all been kind of allocated to us now. But like, these are people getting used to our ways of working and having to start talking to unions and things like that. And it's trying to sort out a big problem at a time when we need kind of more rapid mobilization of staff. So it doesn't really add to it because, you know, for us, like, we want to train people, get them experience, and they're able to make more decisions on their own. But at the moment, like, for example, in my department, there's five specialists, you know, including one director of public health. But like, every decision, serious decision, will have to be made by one of us, you know. Now our staff are great and they're amazing, so that's lucky for us. But, you know, at the same time, there's a big difference between that and actually being able to have somebody who's going to be there for a long time and be able to reinvest in them, you know.
Sorry, Martin, if I come in, just, but when we talk about, I don't like to keep going back to the opportunities that we've missed, and we have missed opportunities, but we're in the middle of this wave. The numbers are pretty steady. They're still not exactly coming down as much as we'd like to see. And we know that we're talking now up to the 5th of March. After the 5th of March, what would you like to see in terms of a roadmap, I suppose, is a very, it's a broad question, but I think it's an important one.
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? And it's one I think is very topical at the moment. I think there's two party lines at the moment being drawn in the sand about it. But I think, I suppose if I was to talk diplomatically or about it, I would say that we actually need to see where we are. I think, you know, a lot of stuff has been put in place very quickly. And I'd like to see what we don't have or what we could improve on and look at other countries that are dealing with it and see how they're doing. And I suppose that's something I've spoken a bit about on Twitter, about border controls and issues like that. I mean, it's inevitably a government decision to do something like that. But I suppose I would like to see work done on how this might be done or how we might put more controls in place, because we might need it. You know, we might need it for another reason, something more severe than we planned for originally. And I just think not having infrastructure in place, or even plans for infrastructure that are complicated plans in place, can leave us a bit vulnerable. And I think that's something that we really need to address.
I just want to come in on that point, though, because it's really important that we talk about that as you yeah. say, almost game theory it forward and say, what's the worst case scenario? What could happen? Because we did hear too often said between December and January, oh, no one saw this coming. And you're going, well, surely that's a failure to plan then, you know, or a failure to even predict out.
Well, I think I feel because the issue has been so severe and it's been so, I suppose we've been such in a tactical mode for months now, that, you know, that we need to actually step back a little bit. And I think, you know, cool ourselves a little bit and think about what actually we need to do and how we need to prepare properly. Like, these shouldn't be surprises. Viral mutations happen. You can get more infectiousness, you can get more severity, you can get less infectiousness, although that strain will probably die down, and you can get less severity. So it's just, these things will change, they evolve, and it's really important to be ready for all the different scenarios. I suppose I've spoken that I'm a little bit worried that our whole strategy is immunization. But I think, like, the likelihood is everything will be fine. But, you know, what if it isn't, or what if other things could come at us that we're not prepared for? And I suppose we have to look at this being a more medium term situation than something that's just going to be all over and done with in a couple of months. And I suppose when you look at the viral spread across the world at the moment, there's an awful lot of countries where it's very uncontrolled. So the opportunity for mutation is higher. That's a fact. We know that. So that, to me, sets a warning sign for us, I think. It says to us to be actually that this will be more of a medium term issue than we might imagine.
In the early days, they weren't particularly worried about more severe mutations. They had my perception anyway, is that they had a feeling that all mutations would be milder and that might you mutate to something altogether milder. But there's absolutely no guarantee of that. I mean, that was seen in the Spanish flu as well. There was no guarantee of things getting milder. Do you think we should have been prepared for a curveball like that?
I think I think that it is helpful to be thinking about the wider risks, you know, and thinking about the kinds of things that can happen. I suppose that is part of planning, isn't it? And part of strategy. It's about having fallbacks in place and things in place in case things don't work out as we imagine. I suppose I want to talk a little bit, maybe just go back, as you made an interesting point there about how we first perceived COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2. You know, how we first we wondered if it was as severe as we as it looked to be at the start. And I suppose when we went back, when we were dealing with flu in 2009, I remember the first mortality rates that were reported out of, I think it was Mexico at the time, and it was about 10%. And you always expect a really high mortality rate at the start of a pandemic because you're not picking up all the cases, you know. So the thing is, it looks, the ones you are picking up are severe because you're actually testing the severe ones and your lab capacity is aimed towards severe. So you're always kind of lulled. You get a bit of a fright at the start, but then from our experience in the past and putting the public health community, things settle down very quickly. And the flu pandemic in 2009, you know, the case fatality rate, you know, went down an awful lot. And then it became something that was, you know, endemic and came, you know, circulates as well. So I suppose that's something that happens. We change our perception of things as things go. And I think this is something for COVID as well, that, you know, we're still adjusting to it, I suppose, and looking at it and looking at the general risk.
That is a really interesting point, because it comes back to what we didn't know last March, even last February, as this started to become an issue that we knew was actually okay. It's here. It's going to be prevalent. But some of the environmental things, like we've spoken to Orla Hegarty several times and John Wenger, and they talk about, you know, the things in terms of those sort of planning. Like, I mean, I've seen quotes of a couple of million quid to for every school in the country to receive at least one air quality monitor. I mean, are these the sort of things that you'd like to see at least trialed and used, as you, because you said you want to start trialing things to see how it changes things now?
Yeah, well, I think the thing is that I think every public health response needs multidisciplinary involvement. It needs contribution from a range of people. You know, it's behavioural scientists. For example, when we looked at when Ebola was being dealt with in Africa, anthropologists were really, really key, you know, because they were able to kind of dig deep into the understanding around how people, the burial customs, which was actually facilitating spread. So there's always a contribution to be given from so many disciplines, and I think that's really important. And everyone has something to contribute on this particular issue, I think, because of the virus. I'd definitely like to see us looking at more evidence, more research, putting effort into this, because I think it is something that we're going to be dealing with in the medium term. And there's probably additional benefits as well. You know, if you reduce one respiratory virus, you're reducing other respiratory viruses as well. So there's layers of benefit here, you know.
Have you any thoughts on why, we'll say, the more modern Western economies have been worse at handling this?
It's experience, I think, isn't it? Other countries were used to dealing with things like SARS and MERS, and I think were able to mount a response. Are you going to ask me, is it because they're women leaders as well, Martin?
I think it probably is a factor of that as well. I just think, I mean, they don't live altogether different lives the way we live our lives, and yet they've been able to keep it quite so suppressed. I know there are cases in countries showing up now, but they've been very good compared to us. We've been kind of the bad boys in school, and I mean that Ireland, the UK, America, we've been pretty shocking at handling this.
Yeah, I think it's preparedness, isn't it? And I think it's possibly culture. Using mask wearing, for example, is more normal and usual in some of those countries. I think some of the countries have put in border controls, and they were very strict about them at the start, and there's a lot of quarantining, and that was useful for some of them as well. So it's complicated, really, you know.
My brother in Australia is gone drive about with the family he's got today, because they went full suppression. They don't call it zero COVID. They call it suppression. They suppressed it everywhere. And I'm just thinking, what's the psyche difference? How come that they could do it and have a country that they can move around in, and the kids can go to school, and we're stuck in this kind of real, as I would say, we're still on the battlefront. We haven't caught our breath yet. It's still the first engagement.
I suppose it's the interconnectedness with Europe. Europe has been very badly affected as well, you know, and I think that's definitely a factor. I think as well as that, it depends on the kind of structuring and the development of public health as well. In some of these countries, they definitely be well developed compared to ourselves in this country anyway. I think there was just a kind of a readiness to listen to that and to act fairly quickly.
I mean, a lot of these countries have had, they have standing ready pandemic units that are, you know, that's public health trained in those concepts. And a lot of them, funnily enough, were supported by Western countries for years because we wanted to keep it over there in many ways. If there was an outbreak, make sure it doesn't come here. And they were better at it than us. And it does seem to be, the more I listen to epidemiologists in the US, they talk about the fact that, you know, they had better people working for American people across the globe than were on any of the Trump teams, you know, in the last year. And that's very, very apparent. I suppose if we were to give you a bag of tricks that you could pull anything out of, what would you like to pull out of resource-wise or even if it's culture-wise, what would you, you know, what would be your big ask if you could?
I had a magic wand. We might go into magic wand territory first, but
absolutely.
I suppose why not? You know, it's Saturday morning, it's the weekend, but I think firstly, we need, across Europe in general, I think we need better disease surveillance, infectious disease surveillance, better connections between the different countries. Like, we do have them under international health regulations, but the IT infrastructure is non-existent in a lot of countries, it's not great in our own as well, and they're not connected to one another. So it's very much relying on me phoning my focal point in the Health Protection Surveillance Centre and then them contacting by phone the person in Germany about that case that came in from Germany or whatever. So it's very, it's still not set up in a way to be reactive quickly to threats. You know, it could be a lot better, I think, and more supported by information technology. Also, I think it's about staffing as well and skill sets, you know, within our own country, within public health. We haven't really changed a lot since 95 when we were set up, 1995. We kind of missed out on the last reform when the health boards were taken away and the HSC was formed. We got put into a health and wellbeing division, which was nationally, but it kind of severed our links and our local governance with our local hospital groups, our local community healthcare organizations. I suppose that is hopefully something that will be changed if Sláinte Care is implemented. But it just means that the response is not locally driven. And I think that's something that's really important in public health. You know, I think in public health, a big mistake that's been made across a lot of countries is that they think they can make it a national function, make it all national. And they'll deal with the population as national, let's deal with it as a national issue. And public health does need to have a national element because you need somebody to set a direction, you need someone to create guidance and that kind of thing. But you also need someone on the ground like myself in a regional department who knows the area, knows the people, is able to call people up and find out what's going on. And that's really the important tie. And I think in England, for example, they discovered that as well. They made these big, you know, privately outsourced contact tracing centres, but actually some local departments in England, the councils, they set up their own, and they were way better at finding and completing contact tracing on people because they'd go after them and they'd find them. And they were trained as well. Like, that's the big difference as well. Look, we haven't had investment in public health staff in Ireland, and that's something I would really like to see as well, that we would actually develop this multidisciplinary workforce with people from different backgrounds and more of people like me as well, because I mean, at the start of this pandemic, we had about a third of the consultants or specialists of New Zealand and Scotland, which were similar sized countries. So we really we started off very weak, and I suppose the issues that are going on around the consultant contract at the moment are really key to that, because if we're not given those kinds of leadership jobs. It's not attractive to people coming from abroad. It's not attractive to people graduating at the moment, qualifying as public health consultants currently. And like this skill set is very sought after at the moment, and junior colleagues have been offered jobs at many multiples of the wages here to go and work remotely for England because they're desperate. And, you know, we just need to actually invest a little bit in the public health workforce and organize it in a way that will make it responsive. So I suppose my global wish or my international wish is more sharing, better sharing, more technology to enable that to happen quickly, more staffing and more standardization between the different countries. And then my national wish is something similar for ourselves. And I suppose another thing too is just the diversifying more into public health practice outside of infectious diseases and outside environmental issues. That's what we're legally required to do. But we also need to look at the other things that affect health as well, like healthcare planning, screening services. We need to look at things around healthy behaviours and lifestyle. So there's an awful lot of other issues that we can do, but we don't do because we're not staffed to do that here in Ireland.
It sounds like you are looking beyond COVID, that you can see a future beyond COVID. And I think that's optimistic. It's nice to talk to somebody who looks and sees something beyond COVID. Will it leave a hole in the Irish health service? Will it leave it worse or will it leave it better?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? Yeah. Wasn't there that quote about the Chinese diplomat who was asked, you know, what were the effects of the French Revolution? And he said, I haven't seen it yet.
It's too early to tell.
It's too early to tell, yeah. It's a bit like that. I think The immediate things that I worry about our healthcare staff. I worry about how they have the year that they've had. I know others have had it worse. And I worry about us losing staff because of that. And I think that's really, really, really acute issue, because what will happen once this pandemic, we get this under control, we get vaccinations in place and things start to settle, there will be this groundswell of medical issues that did not get addressed during the pandemic, mental health as well as physical health. And there has to be something there in place. It has to be organized well to actually deal with that. And that's what I worry, is that you'll suddenly have this exhausted workforce that you're expecting then to deal with another wave of something else entirely. And I think that's something that needs to be thought about. So that's the first thing I really worry about. I think we need to look after healthcare staff and plan that for a situation where people may need time. They may need time to be out. They may need time to recover. We may need to find new staff if people leave as well. So that's something that needs to be thought about now. And not, it shouldn't be a surprise to us in a year's time. It should not be a surprise to us in a year's time. There can be some good things as well. Like, a lot of people are working with different agencies that we didn't work with before, and we're linked in a way that we were probably not linked in before. So, you know, we're on the phone to people every day that we hadn't worked with before. So it's actually, that's really, really nice. I think we can learn something from that, and maybe a bit more remote working as well. So that's helpful as well, I think, going forward. Maybe it allows more people from across the country work in different places. So that's a positive. So there's some positives too. It's driven some innovation, and it's kind of shown people that they can change quite quickly if they need to. But I just think we have to bear in mind we're going to have a very tired workforce in a while, and they're tired already, really tired. And they've been through a lot, so we need to be ready to pick them up at the other side.
Sorry, go listen to the recent one with Cliona Ní Chealaigh, where she talked about last week being her worst week of 17 years in the front line. It was her worst week, and describing how she had to tell four families on one day that their loved one wasn't going to survive. You know, the actual hurt in her voice, just go listen to it, because, you know, there are people currently saying, oh, well, you know, the R number is down and we've dodged a bullet. There was no bullet dodged. I hate that language. I hate the way it's been used. These numbers are real, people. Rachel, I suppose I know this is a there's also the general public. Here's my bit of a dose of optimism. The general public have seen that things can be done that we were told couldn't be done over the course of this pandemic. And that, you know, that includes changes to the public health service, where we've taken other things in and we've ramped up quite quickly. hopefully this leaves us with a bigger state and a bigger health service that is going to gear up for this. And I suppose the one thing I want is not people to understand, well, let's get back to normal, because normal wasn't cutting it before the pandemic, if that's fair. Do you think that those lessons will be embedded in the health service now, that, well, look, we can't be in a rush to get back to what we had before wasn't actually ready? You know, and the last thing I just recall, it was a 2011 report that said we needed 491 ICU beds that landed on the new government's desk, and it never got actioned, and we didn't even get the half of that. And, you know, they had a decade to do it. So we were left already well under resourced at this stage.
There's a kind of, I worked in the NHS, that's where I trained actually in public health, and it was a really interesting experience, because when I worked there, everyone, you're proud to work in the NHS. It was something that was seen as like a national treasure. And for some reason in Ireland, we look at our healthcare system as a dead loss, as something that doesn't work, will never work. There's no point in worrying about it. Buy your private health insurance and trying to get out of it as quickly as possible. That seems to be our general population approach. We should demand more out of it. It should be something that's a doorstep issue for politicians now. You know, we should expect more from it. It should be funded and organized in a way that actually meets the needs of the people it's meant to care for. I don't think that's too much to ask. I think healthcare is the human right, and I think that's something that we actually need to bring forward, and we need to talk about. So, you know, it upsets me when I hear things like Angola being used to describe healthcare. Healthcare is one of the most precious things you can spend money on and invest in, you know, the health of your citizens. That's how they reach their potential. That's how they live good lives. That's how they have good relationships with the people around them. And I suppose that's what I would like to see, is have that aspiration for. It's, you know, we shouldn't be giving up. We shouldn't accept things as, you know, being enough when they're not, and they haven't been for a very long time. That's what I would like to see us do. I'd like to see us have that ambition for this health service and for the people in it as well.
We tend to forget that we were a sick country before COVID.
Yeah.
We had close to 1 million people on waiting lists. So that's, you know, that's a sick country. And if they're not getting addressed, they become acute. The acute hospitals then get overwhelmed with people who should have been seen 6, 12 months, 2 years earlier on a waiting list, and they wouldn't present then as acute. I think you're right, it will become a doorstep issue for an election, but the problem is we may not be able to have an election for quite a long time. So the change in the psyche will come post the fact. Do you think you have enough healthcare workers to get you through? I mean, the attrition rate is very high at the moment. 5,000-6,000 healthcare workers out sick. Can't really survive on that level of attrition.
Yeah, I think some services, they're also seeing staff resign and give up as well, which we're seeing as well in our service, because of the tough year that we've had. That's what I'm saying, really, is that, you know, we will have the waves of COVID to deal with, and then we'll have the waves of post-COVID to deal with. And we have to realize that. And we can't expect a depleted, exhausted workforce realistically to be able to do that without some investment, some thought to that. And I think, you know, there's an awful lot of countries that talk about build back better and things like that, and talk about the recovery phase. That's what needs to be in our strategy and our plan going forward. What does recovery look like? And I suppose I'm a public health person, so I think very broadly in terms of recovery. So it's not just about, you know, scheduling all the OPDs that got missed, but it's about our social recovery, our emotional recovery, our cultural recovery. Like, these are all important as well. These will contribute to our well-being, you know, and our economic recovery as well, of course. You know, these are all things that are really, really important to us as a country. So the thing is, you know, I think it's like being in the ring with a boxer or something like that. I'm not into sports, so I can't really tell you about this, but, you know, we're on our knees a bit at the moment. We need to get off our knees. You know, that's what I think.
Yeah, that's a good point. Very good point. Yeah, it is. I find you incredibly calm for being in such a difficult situation. You are a very calm person, and it is a very difficult situation. And thank you so much for coming on and having this chat with us this morning. Tony's been on to me for weeks and weeks saying, we have her coming on, she'll be on. We just have to figure out a time. So we're delighted to have this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
No, it is. It's, and again, I suppose for listeners' benefit, look, it's great to know that there's people there who are thinking about these things through beyond firefighting, yes, but also thinking about the strategies, that the exit strategies, the plans. And I think it's a really important point that we talk about that recovery phase, because there's a lot that's going to have to be. A lot of difficulties for a lot of different parts of our society that need to heal, whether it's grief or whether it's recovery, and indeed even economically, even if we're not in as bad a place as maybe was first advertised. Dr. Marie Casey, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
Reminder to listeners, please, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We have no ads, no sponsors, no nothing, except for you putting your hands in your pocket and throwing us the price of a cup of coffee, because that's what keeps these podcasts going.
And don't forget, tomorrow morning, 12 noon, Sunday special, Tortoise Shack. It's the bee's knees. Just turn up.
Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.